Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Colsey here. Glad to have you with us today. I've got a really interesting show and one that, again, tracks the money to the ultimate source, which is you. My guest today is Tom O'Rourke. He is a state attorney and I guess, family planner, family lawyer, very familiar with federal rules. Tom is at one point was with the Internal Revenue Service, the U.S. Army before that in a uniform capacity,
that's
as
right.
It were. Tom, the theme of today's column is estate versus retirement planning. You bet your life, literally. And we were talking just before the show about the fact that, you and I know a lot of government workers, and I grew up with them, and you grew up with them in this area. A lot of federal workers don't think of themselves as, A, affluent, and they certainly don't think of themselves as having an estate. And yet, in fact, it's just the opposite, correct?
That's absolutely right, Mike. The one thing every retired federal employee has is an annuity from the federal government, which is worth a lot of money. Just before I came here, I did a very simple calculation. A federal employee who retires at age 62 with an annuity of $60,000 a year, in order to buy an annuity that would pay that amount, it would take over $1.5 million. So assuming you retire and the only thing you have is an annuity, your net worth or the value of your assets may well be in excess of $1 million.
Yeah. And, someone in this area, if you've been here 10, 20, 30 years, if you have a home here, if you manage to stay married, you probably have a very sizable estate and just don't think about it because you are a GS-12 or what have you.
Absolutely. And the one thing I've noticed in recent years, all new federal employees are now covered by FERS. And all employees who are covered by FERS get government matching contributions to the TSP. And virtually every federal employee I deal with has a thrift plan balance that's in excess of six figures. I met with a gentleman just yesterday. He had a TSP balance of almost $900,000.
And I think the average American that has any savings, it's something like $13,000.
Oh, yeah. It's well obscene. Under $100,000. So, although federal employees, when they may not have a big bank account, they may not have a big investment portfolio, but many of them own a home, which in most areas is worth a significant amount of money. But even if they don't, they have an annuity. Even if they didn't save a nickel in the thrift plan.
And you're right. And that's for life. It's for life plus, in fact.
Right.
You can leave it. So it's an invaluable amount of money, and people just sort of take it for granted. I know two fellows, one's retired, one still working. They both built their own business here in the Washington area, and they both offered 401k plans to their employees, which is unusual. And they both offered a 5% match, which is incredibly unusual. So they would match it. They said none of their employees would have taken it. The government is very aggressive about that. You automatically get a 1% from the government. But to get a 5% tax-deferred pay raise year after year after year and the value of compounding, that's an incredible amount of money.
Yeah. I will never forget, I was asked to write a column for some publication a number of years ago, and the column was about investing in the TSP. And the person who published the publication gave it a very catchy name, How to Become a Millionaire Legally.
Oh, yeah.
And all you do is you start putting a little bit of money in the TSP when you're a new employee and allow the government matching contributions to build up, allow your investment earnings to grow. And before you know it, you're talking about real money.
Right. And that, the value of the compounding and then that 5% extra amount from the government is just, it's just invaluable. I wanted to tell the listeners two things. One, our phone number here is 202-465-3080. That's 202-465-3080. If you want to give us a call, talk about it. I think I first met you, Tom, years and years ago at an FDR, Federal Dispute Resolution Conference.
Right, in Palm Springs, in August.
Sunny California, wonderful. But I was new to it, and it was it's a wonderful event. Wish I still went to them, but it's a wonderful event. But there were a number of people conducting seminars, and I wanted to sit in on each one, you know, go in for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, be polite, catch the thing, and then move on. But I wanted to cover the waterfront, and it would have taken a couple of days to do all that. I went into yours at the beginning, and it was 2 hours, and I was mesmerized. I did not leave. I loved it. That's where we got to know each other.
Sure.
Started corralling you to do radio shows and guest columns for me. But it's just so helpful. I mean, I feel like I could, Lorne Larson's in there watching the phones. I'm out here, but I think I could just leave and let you go. But would you just take it from here? What you normally do when you talk to people?
Sure. I as you know, I speak at seminars quite frequently, and one of the topics I regularly talk about is estate planning. And I say, I always start pretty much the same way. I tell everybody, whether you have a lot of money, a little bit of money, or no money at all, you need three basic elements in your estate plan. And most people think estate planning, the guy's talking about wills. Well, yeah. I am talking about wills, but I think for most individuals, a much more important tool is a power of attorney, a document in which you appoint somebody you love and trust to step in and manage your affairs if you lose the ability to manage your own affairs. And there are two types of powers of attorney: a financial power of attorney, somebody who manages your money, and secondly, a medical power of attorney, a medical directive, somebody who could decide mm-hmm. whether you live or die, decide whether to pull the plug when you're terminally ill, or alternatively, who decides what sort of medical treatment you're going to get? Should that tumor be operated on? Should you be placed in a nursing home? Somebody to be aware of your health situation and make decisions for you when you can't make them for yourself. So those are two of the three tools in a power of attorney: a medical power of attorney, a financial power of attorney, and then the third tool is a tool that makes sure your assets go where you want them to go in the event of your death. And there are a number of different ways to do that. The way most people think of is a will, and a will certainly does that. It lays out how you want your assets distributed. But there are some informal tools, particularly for federal employees. Most of the benefits federal employees have, you can designate a beneficiary for. And a beneficiary designation makes sure your assets go where you want them to go after you die. Your TSP balance, who's a survivor annuitant under your annuity, any life insurance you may be entitled to, all of those are handled by beneficiary designations. And another very common informal way to get your property where you want it to go is through a joint ownership arrangement. It's my experience in dealing with married couples that many times husband and wife own assets jointly. And if one of them dies, those joint assets automatically go to the surviving joint owner. So you can use a will, you can use a beneficiary designation, you can use jointly owned property arrangements. And another tool that people are using quite frequently now is a revocable trust, a trust which is set up while you're alive. You retain the right to revoke or change it, and in that trust, you specify what happens when you die. The big advantage of the revocable trust is you retain complete control of it while you're alive, but following your death, it allows your loved ones to wrap up your estate much more quickly and easily because it avoids probate.
Well, I see Mike O'Connell, who edits my column. He does the Nearly Useless Factoid with the bottom of the column. Very popular feature. People love it, and Mike does his homework. Meredith Summers sometimes does it as well. And today, at the bottom of my column today, he says the average cost of a funeral in the U.S. is, $8,000 to $10,000, which is something a lot of people don't think about. But you are.
Yeah, and one of the things that I have been doing with increasing frequency as part of an estate plan, many people will plan their own funeral. Mm-hmm. That $8,000 to $10,000 does not surprise me at all. In fact, I see many situations where it can be substantially higher. And it's always a very difficult decision to make. Mom or dad has just passed away. You're meeting with the funeral director. You've got to make a decision immediately. Yeah. You don't leave the funeral home without writing a check to pay for it. And many times people are thinking, well, you know, we want to get the best casket, the best type of arrangements. And $8,000 to $10,000 is average. I've seen many situations where it bumps up close to $20,000. So that is a very significant cost. And many times the deceased person wouldn't want to spend that money. Yeah. I know I've always joked with my family that when I die, I want them all to go out to a Chinese restaurant, get one of those little containers that they send you home with, wash it out.
Yeah.
Dump my ashes in it and do whatever you want with them because I'm going to be dead.
Like a formal Irish wedding.
Absolutely.
$1,000 in a letter. Lauren Larson's giving us the hook here. We'll be right back talking with Tom O'Rourke about estate planning and retirement. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tom O'Rourke. He is a Washington-based estate attorney and estate planner. And Tom, could you give your email or phone number if people want to reach you?
Sure. My email address is T, as in Tom, O'Rourke, O-R-O-U-R-K-E, at Miles, M-I-L-E-S, Stockbridge, S-T-O-C-K-B-R-I-D-G-E.com. And my phone number is 301-517-4821. Okay. And I can be reached at either of those, probably preferably by email because I'm away from my office quite often.
And in fact, you're here now, and our number here is 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. And I wanted to ask you a question that some might think is silly, but the difference between retirement planning and estate planning, it's actually quite a bit different, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Retirement planning is very, very broad. It includes taking all the steps necessary to prepare you for retirement. A small part of that retirement plan is your estate plan. The estate plan really plans for the transition of your affairs near the end of your life, when you're disabled or when you die. But a retirement plan is much, much broader. I know one of the folks you have as a guest quite often is Tammy Flanagan. Mm-hmm. And Tammy knows the federal benefit system about as well as anybody that I've ever met. And I'm sure she will tell you, certainly the most important thing in planning for retirement is to make sure you're going to have enough assets to allow you to live the type of life you want to live for the rest of your life. But a part of that retirement plan is also planning your estate. Now, in addition to planning for how much money you're going to need, your retirement plan takes in a whole lot of other issues. For example, what do you want to do when you retire? Right now, you spend about 50 hours a week between driving to and from work and working. What are you going to do when the most important thing you have to do for the day is write a check to pay your utility bill? How are you going to stretch that over 8 hours? There's going to be a big gap there. And I regularly deal with a lot of federal retirees who really are absolutely delighted they could retire at age 55. They're still relatively young, healthy. And after a year or two, they get bored to death and they look for something else to do and they go back to consult. But planning for what you're going to do is important. Planning for your health care, making sure your health insurance is in line. Do you want to move to a retirement community? Are you sick and tired of shoveling snow? Do you want to move somewhere where all you have to do is pick up a phone to the maintenance crew and they'll take care of all that for you? So retirement planning is much, much broader. And I know you have heard the statement that many people that are into retirement planning, people say it all the time. You start planning for retirement on your first day on the job. And that is really true. That's especially true for federal employees because many of the plans that can make a really big difference in how much money you have, the sooner you take advantage of them, the more you're going to have when you retire. And for new employees, for all employees, I think the best thing they can do is put as much money into the thrift plan as they can afford and as the law allows. But so retirement planning is really, really a very broad term. Part of that retirement plan is your estate plan. It has a much more narrow focus.
Well, I remember as a young guy at the Washington Post, very, very young, I think the youngest reporter ever, And I would hear the older guys, these old 45 and 50-year-old sure. men, talking about they didn't know what they were going to do when they retired. And the place did not have a particularly good retirement system. And I thought, boy, I know what I'll do when I retire. I'm going to be on a surfboard at Ocean City every day. Well, you know, you retire at 60, 70, whatever. You're not going to be on a surfboard at Ocean City every day. You change, the situation changes, and this idea of what am I going to do is a very real concern.
Well, I know I had the very same attitude when I first started mm-hmm. to work for the government. I figured, well, you know, I'm not maybe making as much money as I could elsewhere, but I'm going to retire when I'm 55. Yep. And that was very attractive to me. And I think it is for many individuals. But one of the things I've observed over the year from teaching retirement seminars and from dealing with a lot of retirees, early retirement looks a lot less attractive the closer you get.
Yep.
And that's something that many people find out.
You know what fascinated me? For years, there was this push to have phased retirement.
Sure.
And they finally got it through Congress, I think almost 2 years ago now. OPM was roundly criticized because it took so long to issue the regulations. But as you know, the devil's in the detail in sure. these things. And OPM finally issued a good set of regulations by most critics. And they left it pretty much up to the agencies. It's your call, but we suggest these certain parameters. And there's really no time limit in it. You could go into phased retirement for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. The idea is you'd work part-time 50% of the time and spend X amount of that time mentoring people, presumably who would replace you. But it seemed to make a lot of sense, and there was such a clamor for it. And yet, Washington Post last week reported that, or government executive, I'm sorry, reported that by their count, 31 people government-wide have applied for phased retirement. Now, I would have thought entire buildings would implode and people would run out the window, just the exact opposite.
That's amazing.
Is that a reality check?
I'm really kind of shocked by that
yeah.
because I've heard the same anecdotal evidence you did. People say, boy, I'd love to.
Absolutely.
You know, I want something to keep me busy, but I don't want to have to be there 9 to 5, 5 days a week.
Right, and we here at Federal News Radio, everybody got calls and emails. When's it going to happen? What about my agency? The Agency for International Development was early on. Housing and Urban Development was early on. I think the Library of Congress in offering it, but according to them, less than 40 people have applied government-wide.
That's so amazing.
Tells you something. Yeah. I want to ask you something too. We hear this all the time, particularly when we're doing financial planning shows or talking about the Thrift Savings Plan, which, by the way, is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Warren Buffett once told me, not Warren Buffett, John Bogle of yeah. Vanguard, once told me, he said, I'd like to be in the Thrift Savings Plan because of the low fees and the 5% match. Alan Roth from CBS Money Watch and now AARP, he said he's trying to figure out a way to get into the TSP. So if you're not in it and you're not maxing out, not putting in at least 5%, there's something wrong somewhere.
Yeah.
That said, a lot of times people, they'll get in one of these life cycle funds. You know, the target date is 2020 or 2030 or 2050. But they'll get in a fund and they'll say, that's when I plan to retire. And I know you and others who've looked at this over the years say the date you plan to retire and the date that you're going to start tapping into your TSP can be years apart, correct?
Absolutely. Every financial planner I've ever dealt with will tell you that the single most important determining factor in determining how to invest your money is when are you going to need it? When are you going to need to take that money out and spend it? The longer your time horizon, the longer until you're going to withdraw the money, the more aggressive you can be in your investing. And with many federal employees, I see a lot of federal employees who retire in their late 50s. If they want, they can just allow their money to sit there untouched, continue to invest it until they're 70. So yep. what you really need to look at is not the date you're going to retire, but the date you're going to need to dip into the money and start using it to support your retirement lifestyle.
And for most people, that's years after you retire. And I ask you this as a question, not as a statement. If you're going to start tapping the money immediately upon retirement, maybe you're retiring too soon.
Absolutely right. If you're tapping into your money right away, I assume you're doing that because you need it to yep. support your lifestyle. Well, if you need it, maybe you should work a little longer and build a little cushion. Mm-hmm. I will never forget, I got a call from a lady. I was interrupted in the middle of a seminar because of an emergency call. And right away I thought, oh my God, something mm-hmm. happened to one of my kids. But it was a federal employee client of mine who was told she had been offered an early out. And I had been representing her in a tax matter. And the problem was she didn't have enough money to meet all of her obligations, mm-hmm. including her taxes. And she said to me, Tom, I got to make this decision right now. And I said, ma'am, you don't have enough money to meet your current lifestyle. Yeah. And when you retire, you're going to be making less money. You can't afford to retire. But so if you need to tap that money right away to allow you to meet your basic living needs, it probably would be prudent for you to continue to work a while longer.
It's the old line, if you have to ask how much it costs, you can't afford it, right. In reverse.
That's right.
Yeah. I heard this, I heard it a couple of times from people, and I heard it a lot anecdotally, and that is people who desperately needed money for something, and they'd say, well, I'll take the $25,000 buyout, and that'll be fine. Well, A, you're taking $16,000 to $18,000 right. after deductions, and B, if you're so desperate that you need that money, you even more desperately need to have a steady job.
You're absolutely right. You need that consistent cash flow. And although the federal retirement system is a model for all retirement systems, wherever you work, when you retire, you're going to have less money coming in than you do while you're working. So if you have a desperate need for money, you need to keep working. And maybe if you need more, look for a part-time job or something other than tapping into your TSP money. The other thing I tell people all the time is one of the biggest mistakes you can possibly make when you retire is to simply pull your money out of the TSP. Oh, yeah. Take it out, use it to pay off, whatever.
Oh, I want to get back to that. We need to take a short break okay. here, but that's an interesting point. Be right back here on Your Turn, talking with Tom O'Rourke. Be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tom O'Rourke. He is a Washington area attorney. Actually, his offices are in Rockville, and he handles a lot of federal workers, and so he knows the drill, knows the benefits thing, knows the thrift savings plan, and was explaining in the first part of the show the difference between retirement planning and estate planning, and they're in the same ballpark, but they're quite different things, and you do need to do both. Tom, before we were so rudely interrupted by a commercial there, we were talking about the thrift savings plan, and you know, you said you have clients who they'll hit that 70 and a half age group, and if they're retired, they have to start taking required minimum distribution, RMD.
Right.
And it a lot of people don't like it because it's almost like somebody's taking the money away from them. The government wants to tax it, so that's the reason for that. And there's an actuarial formula that they use. But in fact, you don't have to spend that RMD, correct?
That's true. I tell people that all the time. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference yeah. between taking it out and paying taxes on it and spending it. And I do have a fair number of clients who tell me, look, I am getting by quite well financially on yeah. my annuity. That's particularly true for CSRS employees. And they simply don't need the money and would like to allow that money to stay in the TSP and continue to grow tax deferred. But as you said, if you're retired when you reach age 70 and a half, you have to start withdrawing the money. So if you've got to take out $10,000, and there's a relatively simple formula for calculating how much you have to take out when you reach 70 and a half, it's somewhere around 4%, a little less than 4% of your balance. You don't have to spend it. You take out the $10,000, you pay taxes on it, and you can reinvest the money, not in the TSP right. or an IRA, but somewhere else. So, and I do deal with a fair number of folks who don't need the money and simply take it out and put it in a savings account or a CD or invest it yeah. in wherever they want to invest it.
Tom, we're roughly the same age. I know you're younger, but we both get these, maybe once a week, get a letter, an invite to dinner. Somebody wants to take us to dinner with another group of seniors.
Sure.
And usually they're either selling timeshares or condos or places in a retirement home. or they're selling annuities. And what do you think about that?
Well, I've heard a statement many, many times that annuities are sold; they are not bought. An annuity is a product that, if you buy from a financial services representative, that individual will get the highest commission of anything they can possibly sell you. So step number one is you need to realize you're really helping that person out.
Okay.
And many times it is not in your best interest because it's very inflexible. Once you invest the money, you can't say, whoops, I need a mistake, or I need $10,000 out right away to put a new roof on my house that got damaged by the snowstorm. It's not easy to get your money out. And I remember a few years ago, the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, did an investigation of people who have these dinner seminars. And I don't remember the specific figures, but they found some astounding number, something like 20% of them are completely fraudulent. The things they're selling you are simply scams. A much higher percentage are not scams. They are selling you legitimate products, but they're not necessarily products that are in your best interest.
I remember when they were setting up the Federal Employees Retirement System to replace the CSRS program, and a lot of people thought there must be some plot to it. They're out to get us, and it happened during the Reagan administration. So some of the unions were suspicious of it. But in fact, the people that developed it, I knew a lot of them, Senator Ted Stevens' office and at the Congressional Research Service, some of the best minds in government. They said, we can't sustain the CSRS program any longer. We can't. We'll keep it going for the people that are in it, but we can't do it for the future. So we're going to have something that's like the best retirement program in the private sector. And that is that there's a federal component, the FERS, there's a Social Security component, and then there was the TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan. And at the time it was set up, I recall they said the average TSP investment will provide one-third to one-half of all the income that that first retiree has in retirement. One-half to one-third, huge amount of money. Of course, the asterisk, the kicker was you have to contribute. You have to put in at least 5% to get that 5% match. The TSP now has a number of millionaires. And at first, those millionaires were primarily high-priced lawyers who came into government as federal judges, and they brought their outside money with them. These are smart men and women,
sure.
And they looked at the federal thrift savings plan, and they looked at their old law firm 401k, and they said, I'm moving into this. So at first, they were bringing the money in, but since that time, a number of people are homegrown TSP millionaires. I've talked to three of them. A friend of mine has one or two as clients, so they're around the Washington area. But these are people who have that $1 million-plus nest egg. Some cases, it's $2 million. But I know you're reluctant when people, and then there's tremendous pressure on people who are now in the TSP to, when they leave the government, to take that money out and invest it somewhere else where they will have either, quote, more control or more choices. What do you think about that?
Well, I've read the same articles about the TSP you've read by people like John Bogle, who's the founder of Vanguard and index
father
fund
of the
investing.
Index fund.
But if you simply go on Google and type in TSP, you will literally find thousands of articles, all of which are very complimentary.
Yeah.
These are people who are very sophisticated, and they all say the same thing. Number one, it's very low cost. Number two, it offers all of the vehicles anybody really needs. You don't need to invest in 10,000 stocks. You need five simple funds that allow you to put your money and take advantage of various sectors, which is what the TSP does. So you already have what most financial advisors say is the ideal investment vehicle. So why do you want to switch away? Now, is there a possibility you could do better with a private financial advisor? Sure, there's a possibility, but I think something like 85% of individual advisors don't do as well as index funds do. So you're already in something that beats investment advisors 85% of the time. Now, the big reason many people want to put money into an IRA is they have more flexibility regarding how they take the money out. Once you have it in an IRA, you can take it out anytime you want to. If you need $40,000 to buy a new car, you call your investment advisor and say, wire transfer $40,000 into my bank account. And you don't have that level of flexibility with the TSP. But for most people, it's a long-term financial vehicle. And if you think you're going to need some money immediately accessible, well, you can take out part of the money in the TSP, roll it into an IRA, and leave the balance, continue to sit in the TSP.
Well, you know, that accessibility is a two-way street, too, and I have a very old-fashioned approach to that. But my credit union was through the Washington Post, but it merged, like many others, with a variety of them now. It's in Alexandria. It's not at all convenient to me. I don't have a withdrawal card, so when I want money from that credit union, I have to get in my car on a Saturday, limited window time, drive 28 miles, stand in line and get it. And that's been a blessing for me because I have a lot more money in the credit union than I would have if it was down the street or if I had a wire transfer deal with them.
Absolutely. And somehow you managed to live without that 50 bucks. You would have needed to go out to lunch or whatever.
I can't live without.
And it's amazing the more accessible it is, which is one of the reasons why many people, the key to getting out of debt for many people is pay cash.
Yeah.
And if you have to pay cash,
you see what it is.
You somehow decide, you know, I don't necessarily need to go out to lunch and pay 15 bucks. I can bring a sandwich from home. And so that's accessibility can be as much of a curse as it is a blessing.
You were talking about the way the TSP is run, and it's probably one of the most monitored financial organizations in the country. The Labor Department looks at it. The Internal Revenue Service looks at it. The House and the Senate, they not only look at it, they have money in the TSP.
Right.
They're participants. A number of people regulate this. And one of the things, the unsung heroes of the TSP are the officials there, and they're all career civil servants. But the way they have fought off attempts from politicians and pressure groups and whatnot to add funds to the TSP that wouldn't necessarily be in the best interests of the shareholders. And I'm thinking of, there was a big push years ago to get REITs, real estate investment trusts, in it. And everybody said, no matter what happens to the real estate market, REITs are sound as the Rock of Gibraltar, nothing will ever happen. Well, along came 2008, and many people were saved because there was not a REIT in the thrift savings plan. The same with these people that wanted to set up funds for precious metals, green funds, various social avenues. And as you pointed out, in your index funds, there are those things in them. There are REITs in them. There are precious metals or anything, but in a much safer quantity.
Well, everything I read about retirement planning, and I do a lot of reading about this stuff because I'm involved with it all the time, the opinion is consistent. All you need are basically a small cap fund, a large cap growth fund, a bond fund, an international fund, and a money market fund, which is basically what the thrift plan has. And that all of these other investments that cover very narrow sectors can be very risky. You can make a lot of money, but you also take a big risk.
Okay. In today's column, you gave me some excellent bullet points, and we went over them. Talking about trusts, there's revocable, irrevocable, testamentary, living, and numerous special purpose trusts for the cares of minors, credit protection. What are we talking about here?
Okay.
A pet trust?
A pet trust.
P-E-T as in
people set up pets all the time.
Okay.
Leona Helmsley set up a pet trust for the benefit of her dog.
Mm-hmm.
Leona didn't have a lot of friends, but she loved her dog.
Yep.
And she set up a trust to provide for the dog. You can establish a trust for virtually any legal purpose that you want. And all a trust is, it's a vehicle where you set aside money to be managed by one person for the benefit of another. Now, probably the single most common trust used for estate planning purposes is what is commonly called as a revocable or revocable living trust. It's revocable because you retain the right to revoke or change it. It's living because it's created to take effect while you're alive. You manage the property for your benefit while you're alive, and then when you die, a person who you named as your successor steps in.
Now, why would somebody want an irrevocable trust, one you can't revoke?
Well, the irrevocable trusts have a variety of advantages. The big disadvantage is it's inflexible. Once you create it, you can't revoke it or change it. Some of the big advantage, many times people do it for tax planning purposes.
Well, Don, let me cut you off there, the magic word tax. We need to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com. We'll come back to revocable versus irrevocable trusts. Hey, Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Tom O'Rourke, Washington-based attorney, actually offices in Rockville, Maryland. And we were talking about wills and trusts, and I'm going to shut up because Tom is the expert. But Tom, we were talking about the difference between a revocable or a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust.
Right. And again, as I mentioned before we took a break, a revocable trust is the one that's most commonly used because of its flexibility. You can revoke it or change it anytime you want. An irrevocable trust is set up for a whole variety of reasons. For example, you love your daughter dearly. You want to leave everything you have to your daughter. But the problem is your son-in-law leaves something to be desired. Mm-hmm. And you're afraid that if you turn over what you worked a lifetime for to your daughter, your son-in-law will influence her to spend that money. And you want to protect it, or you certainly want to protect it in the event they ever get divorced. So you set up an irrevocable trust that comes into effect after you die. Neither your daughter nor her husband can change any of that terms. The right. funds will be managed for
I
her benefit.
I think there are an awful lot of people out there, and some of us may fall into that category, who don't approve of certain in-laws. Tom, in the column today, we talked about things like, you discussed a medical directive, and you're talking about making a $1 million gift to your children and family members, and part of doing that it involves having a will and having long-term care insurance. And I know my mother, who was a retired government worker, did just that. She had a will, but she had long-term care insurance. She bought it not through the government, but she did buy it. And she was healthy all her life and took good care of herself. But at the end there, last couple of years were pretty bad, dementia, Alzheimer's. And the fact that she had long-term care insurance plus Social Security, she'd worked in the private sector, plus her federal annuity, she'd worked for the government a number of years. It was literally a gift to us, the family. We were out of pocket relatively little compared to what it would have been, and the level of comfort that she had. I mean, it was a horrible situation, but she was in the finest place you can think of. And that was her gift to us, the family.
Well, long-term care insurance is certainly something people should look at in planning for their retirement, because many times the single biggest expense retirees have is health care. And although none of us want to be in a facility where somebody else needs to care for us, it's a reality. It happens to a lot of people, and it's outrageously expensive. To go into many nursing homes, I'm not talking about assisted living facilities, mm-hmm. I'm talking about full round-the-clock nursing care, costs well in excess of $100,000 a year. And even if you have a substantial nest egg, it's easy to deplete that nest egg over the last few years of your life. And that's what long-term care insurance is designed to protect against. And I know you have other folks who are very knowledgeable about long-term care insurance. Usually what I do when I'm meeting with a client is I mention it to them as something you may wish to consider. I go through and I look and see what assets they have. They always want to preserve those assets mm-hmm. to give them mm-hmm. to their loved ones. And many times an important tool in allowing them to do that is to insure against the possibility that everything they have will be spent to provide for their nursing
home
care.
People talk about spending down to get to Medicaid levels. You don't want to do that.
No, you don't want to have to do that.
And the level of comfort is vital at that stage of the game. The thing that always strikes me, back when I got long-term care insurance, I got it through the Washington Post. It was a group plan, very good plan, particularly at the time. and it was with a company that no longer offers long-term care insurance. Now, I'm covered. We in the group are covered, but they won't take any new people. And it's, I think at the time that I got it, there were maybe 50, 60 companies that offered long-term care insurance. Now I believe it's down to 6. Small number, because they found out how horrendously expensive it is. And that means if it's expensive to them, think about what it would be to you if you weren't insured.
You're absolutely right. I don't know the specific numbers, but I do know the number of companies offering it has significantly decreased.
Yeah.
And it's just for that reason. Their experience in paying claims suggests that it can be outrageously expensive.
And there was an obituary in the Washington Post maybe yesterday, if not Friday, a retired federal worker, 99 years old. He was part of the greatest generation, and he had been in Bletchley Park. He helped break the code. Fascinating man. Here's a testamentary trust. Here we go.
All a testamentary trust. It's a trust that becomes effective after you die. Most typically, it's established under your last will and testament. Let's say, for example, you set up a trust for the benefit of one of your children. Mm-hmm. That trust becomes effective at your death. Mm-hmm. Any assets that are left when you die are directed to be paid into the trust. It's a testamentary trust because it becomes effective at your death under the terms of your last will and testament.
Very good. Okay, any final points? We got about a half a minute here.
No, I again, retirement planning is something you need to do as soon as you start to work, and I believe that every single living individual, even if you don't have two nickels to rub together, need a financial power of attorney and a medical power of attorney that sets forth your wishes and picks somebody you trust completely to act on your behalf if you can't act on your own behalf.
And think of your federal annuity, whether it's CSRS or FERS, and think of your thrift savings plan money as part of a fairly decent estate.
Absolutely. If you're a federal employee that gets an annuity of $50,000 a year and you have nothing else, the value of your estate probably in excess of $1 million.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom, for being here. Thanks, Lauren Larson, for producing the show. We hope to see you here next week. Meantime, be careful out there.